apologize, but this wasn't my fault. I was ready on time.
But they put on videotape and stopped the machine. My portrait was too much for them. But anyway, we have an interesting subject this morning. It goes back to perhaps the memories that some of you have of our old friend, the Reverend Sensaki. Mr. Sensaki, who was part Mongolian and part Japanese, was a very good friend of the society. He helped to classify our Chinese and Japanese religious sutras and so forth. And he had a little place which he formed himself. He was a Zen man. And he created what he called the Mentor Garden in San Francisco, the Garden of the Zen Mind. And that is sort of in line with what we are going to discuss this morning. The idea of a beautiful garden that came into the world with man. We were put here with every advantage conceivable. There was every possibility of a wonderful, beautiful existence in a natural environment divinely created. But we got into trouble, as human beings have a way of doing, and we finally lost our participation in this better kind of life. And to sort of compensate for it, we were given another garden, the garden of the mind. If we could put the mind in order and change it from a tumbling ground for whimsies, we might restore the beauty of our original divine purpose. If the mind is put in order, man, through his mind, can put the world back into order. So the mental garden was to be a place where the human being reconstructed, reformed, and regenerated his own inner life. It was like a garden. It was a plot of mental substance. Now, what happened to that plot depended on the individual. He could forget it and just let it lie deserted. He could neglect it somewhat and turn it over to weeds and plants that had no essential value to him or to us, but even so were valuable to the plan to which they belonged if man did nothing about it. Or he could cultivate it and plant flowers that would please him, or he could plant a group of vegetables and feed his family. There were all kinds of things he could do with a garden, and in the same way, there were many uses he could make of his own garden, the garden of his own mind, the garden in which all kinds of flowers could grow and also in which weeds could take over. So the idea of the tree of the mind, the wonderful flowering tree, was to become the symbol of man taking dominion over himself. If he had the courage to build this wonderful happiness tree, as he was getting older physically, he could sit under the shade of it and rest and think and have a beautiful environment in his own closing years. Or, as the Buddhists believe, he could take it with him into the other life, and where he was in paradise, his tree was with him, because it was his tree that made that place paradise. And all those that were there who had the happiness tree were able to live gorgeously, beautifully, graciously, while the angels and birds sang to them and the wise teachers instructed them. Because in the Buddhist heaven, there are no lazy people. You do not learn to play instruments you have no talent for. In the world beyond, you go to school again to get the next assignment. But you get it if you have built up the proper mentality, the proper dedications, the proper ideals. You have the wonderful tree of happiness that has been built up in your own nature. Now, some may feel that a person sitting quietly under his own happiness tree would be very selfish, because there are many people who are not sitting under happiness trees, and that perhaps we should never do things like that. Perhaps we should never have happiness in that way. But these people don't realize the facts of life. In the first place, you can't build your own happiness tree until you have served in every possible way the needs of others. The happiness tree is not something you can build by determining to make yourself happy. This tree must come and bear fruit because of the seeds you have planted. And the seeds you have planted are the good thoughts, the good deeds, the understanding and assistance you have shared with other human beings. The seeds of the trees, therefore, are the virtues that you have cultivated in the practical service of humanity. Every kind word plants a seed. Every cross word allows a seed to die. Every beautiful gesture of helpfulness helps the wonderful happiness tree to grow, where you turn back and refuse to accept the needs of others, then an early frost damages your happiness tree. Everything that is important in the form of compensation for labor is symbolized under the figure of this tree. Every good deed helps it to grow. Every bad deed is a worm in the fruit. Everything that is done unselfishly is a benediction. Anything that is done selfishly reacts ultimately in pain and suffering. So the Buddhist and the Zen man and the Chinese Taoist all have a feeling that we have to make a definite effort to take care of this wonderful inner world, which is a garden of our thoughts and emotions. You can't see it, but it's there. And it manifests itself in the way things happen in the outer life, so that every person has an allotment of potentials. And these potentials are the seeds of his happiness tree. If he does nothing with them, the tree has no life. If he misuses them, the tree is killed. If he neglects them, weeds representing negative thoughts and pernicious habits take over the garden and kill out the good plants. To bring the tree to the flower and the fruit requires dedication to principles. Dedication not to vast, magnificent achievements, any more than when you go out in the garden, you find a great compensation in doing a little weeding. It's just part of making the thing work out. Without care, the garden cannot be kept. Without care, your life cannot be kept. Everything that happens has a meaning, and each person must find ways of making this meaning constructive, useful, and helpful. Now, the happiness tree comes into the life of the person, and today most people are not very happy. There are sorrows, worries, anxieties, all kinds of misunderstandings, violence, anarchy, and conflict and competition. All these things are deeply annoying to the individual. They damage his peace of mind, they intrude upon his personal life, they may destroy his home or alienate his children. Therefore, the average person has a garden that is not in good condition. Perhaps when he started out as a young child with his garden, he planted beautiful flowers there. But in the course of time, he turned his attention to something else, and the flowers were allowed to die out, and the weeds took over. And the weeds in these cases all represent negative conduct. They represent things that are not good, that do not bring happiness, but create habits. And like devil grass, these habits stretch through our mental and emotional atmosphere, destroying most of the peace of mind that we are seeking to strengthen. So we have to start in by realizing that there are two ways of living. One is to control life by integrities, and the other is to let things happen as they will, and the result is a garden that goes to weed. There can be no great achievement without intent. There can be no vast virtue that is not supported by principles. There is no way of compromising with life without loss. We must definitely keep the rules.
We may want to do certain things, but do they interfere with the essential purposes of life? So the Zen man, with his happiness tree, tries to visualize a magnificent flowering plant, something that is more glorious than any plant that you can see in this world. In the Buddhist diagrams and in the paintings, these trees are trees of gems and jewels. Their stems are silver and gold, and they have all kinds of singing birds and beautiful creatures in their branches. And they are filled with marvelous sounds and songs and the most glorious perfumes of rare plants. These are the symbols of the life in order. These are the signs of a person who has found internal values. The singing birds may be his own children, but they are there if he has the proper happiness tree. If for one reason or another he hasn't, then the results are not so beneficial. Now we would think, after watching the world around us and history over a period of nearly 10,000 years, that we would begin to realize the facts of life. We would realize that there are values that we have to cultivate if we want them. And that it's very easy to get into trouble, very difficult to get out of it. And the best way is to prevent the trouble in the first place. Otherwise, we devote our lives to regrets and frustrations and negative consequences of conduct. To begin with the general thought, then, of getting a start on this, we will assume that each person is born with these seeds, which are referred to in Buddhism as the seeds in the Buddha fields, where are planted all the virtues and integrities of mankind. In any event, we have within us the seed of happiness. It is a divine right. Every individual has the right to be happy. Sometimes this happiness is more obvious than at others. Some people are happy doing things that would make other persons miserable. But each person who fulfills himself, who does that which is his natural destiny, and enjoys doing it, has his happiness tree well rooted. If, however, he starts out with good intentions, his education is adequate, his abilities are moderate and sufficient, but he does nothing to improve himself. He takes the attitude that he will have a job and that he will keep the job and he will fuss a little and he will fume a little and he will like a little and love occasionally and hate occasionally until death do them part. That is the end which is going to happen. In this, there seems to be no sense of personal control. The individual has things happen to him which apparently he can do nothing about. The fact that he set up a perfect cause for them never seems to enter his mind as he faces the dilemma. He therefore comes to the conclusion that he is a victim of circumstances. He doesn't realize that the circumstances are inside of himself. Now, if we want happiness to come in terms of the ordinary commonplace that has been generally accepted, we will have to face the simple fact that happiness, as we generally think of it, has never been successful. The individual says, if I had $1 million, I'd be happy. He has $1 million and he isn't happy. Another individual says, if I can get an executive job and come and be the manager of my company, I'll be happy. He gets the job, and his reward is a nervous breakdown. He is not happy. Another one says, I want a career in theater. If I can get an agent that'll get me $1 million a year, I'll be happy. So that happens, and they get $1 million a year, and from that time they're in the Weekly Inquirer with their problems for the rest of their lives. All the way along, the individual's ideas of happiness nearly always a gratification of appetites of some kind. Ambition can be an appetite. Fame can be an appetite. Domination can be. The gradual competitive method by which we can gain control of other people's lives may seem to be just wonderful. But these things are all wrong. And the result is they do not end in happiness. And those who have the most of material things are not the happiest. Those in high station are not happy. Those in public life are in constant danger of assassination. All of these goals that we have once thought would fulfill us have proven to be nothing but snares, causes of sorrow and misery. And in the desperate effort to maintain what we think is happiness, we become not only miserable but sick, and finally die in the quest of that which is beyond our reach. Therefore, we have to begin to decide what happiness is. How can we be happy? That means, in one sense of the word, that we must fulfill something. We must in some way become what we ought to be. This doesn't mean that we're all going to be alike or that we're all going to believe the same things, but each one is going to find the way to make his own happiness tree grow. He would have to use the fertilizer of his choice, but he will still have to decide what he is trying to do, what he really hopes to gain. Well, most of the mystics, including the great teachers of the world, have said that happiness cannot be achieved by direct effort. It is a byproduct. It is the result of other things. Happiness is a reward for something that deserves happiness, earns it, is entitled to it. If we perform a beautiful, gracious deed, we feel good, at least for a moment. That's the reward, and that's how happiness gets into the picture. Happiness is the result of usefulness, of the love of beauty, the forgiveness of our enemies, kindness to those in sorrow and need, patience with situations that are difficult. We're not going to be able to fight our way through all these situations, but we can take the statement of the old sage who said, "Suffer it to be so now, this too shall pass away." And the things we do not like will pass away if we don't nurse them. The worlds of better things can open to us if we will let go of the things that make life unpleasant or unfortunate. Now, when most people, I think, in this modern world, suffer from a little bit of hypersensitivity. We are so sensitive of what other people do to us that we completely forget what we do to them. Therefore, we are constantly bruised, but we do not realize that we also give bruises. And in this development of our happiness tree, the only way we can get rid of the unhappiness which we feel that others are responsible for is to be very wise and loving and make sure that we are not contributing to the unhappiness of someone else. Now, in the law of karma, it may be that you did an unhappy thing to a person who is gone, that you can never ask forgiveness, at least in this life. And therefore, this must stay forever as a black mark on your record. Not necessarily. The individual can dedicate a good deed to the memory of a bad one, and by making a real service, accomplish what is practically the purpose behind the idea of confessional. Confessional involves penance, and the individual can create or decide upon the proper penance that he should exercise or practice as a consequence of his own conduct. If he knows that he has done something that's unkind, just simply to apologize for it and go on and do it again is nothing. But if we have made a mistake, we have the right to prove we've learned a lesson and outgrow that mistake. And the first degree of penance is not to repeat it. If we find that we have a sharp temper, we can stop it. But we can't stop it by claiming that other people are so impossible we have to get angry at them. This is where the mistake is made. The other person's bad disposition is a blight on his happiness tree. When we become indignant at him and have to return his discourtesies, that's a blight on our happiness tree. And if we want that tree to grow properly, we cannot afford to damage it. And everything that is negative interferes with the karmic consequence which we want, called happiness. Now, happiness has a great many interesting problems involved in it. Happiness is not necessarily having what you want. Perhaps it's really more likely understanding what you have. If you think there should be more, then you can be also grateful that there is as much as there is. Always the happiness problem involves the best adjustment to a situation. An adjustment in which the person is perfectly willing to go as far as necessary, as far as he can go with integrity, to cure a situation that has arisen. One of these classic solutions in the time of the Greeks and the Pythagoreans was that every dispute should be solved before sunset. If there was a big fight, the two combatants must sit down before the end of the day and make it up. This was mandatory. No grievance should be taken to bed and slept on. If we do that, then we are really putting an insecticide in the wrong place. We have to be careful about this type of thing. The Indian chief Sitting Bull, who was the medicine chief of the Ogallala Sioux, when two young braves had an argument, he told them to dig a hole. So they dug a hole in the ground. Now he says, shout your hate into the hole. They did so. He said, now cover it up and forget it. So they did so. And because he was the big man and no one could go against it, they had to do what he said. But the best thing to do with a bad scene of some kind is to dig a hole and bury it. Because if you don't, it'll ultimately bury you. So we start in and we say, here is a nice little plant. We want to really love it. It's like one of these bonsai trees. Your mind and your thoughts have to be controlled by discipline. In Japan, and even here now, there are exhibitions of the bonsai trees. These miniature trees are things of exquisite beauty, but the perpetuation of them and the perfection of them is a daily task. There are trees that may be only 12 or 15 inches high and look like a magnificent full-grown oak in a little shallow bowl. That tree has been lovingly guarded, protected, watered, the roots cleared and trimmed, everything done to it, daily watching for a period of 300 years. It has come down through a family for generations. Every member that has guarded it has found in it the secret of a discipline, the discipline of protecting that which you have received in good faith, protecting the labors of the past, and preserving the object for the service and glory of the future. So discipline becomes the way of protecting beauty, preserving life, and making possible to pass more joy, love, and thoughtfulness to those who come after us. So we start in and we say, what have we got here now? What does each individual feel, for instance, in his own life as the thing that is most beautiful, most necessary, most worthwhile? Having decided on something, maybe the individual says, I've always wanted to paint a picture, a beautiful picture. This is my dream. Now, having a dream of painting a picture, the individual can go through all kinds of experiences in the selecting of an artistic career. He can study with a successful artist. He can pass on to the integration of his own thoughts. He can gain a certain amount of talent, but then he has to watch out because ambition is going to sneak in. also competitiveness and a desire for profit. And little by little, his art is going to be profaned if he is not extremely watchful. He's not going to paint the beautiful things he wanted to paint. He's going to paint strange and eccentric and absurd things because they sell better. And there is the end of art. And a nice little happiness tree dies. The moment there is a misuse, the moment an ulterior motive corrupts the integrities of a desire, the individual is in trouble. I've known at least two cases of persons who have made an obligation to themselves. If they ever had $1 million, they would devote it to the works of good. They would help other people. They would take care of the children that didn't have the funds. They would educate young people. When these two persons got $1 million each, not one of them ever spent it on any of the projects he had promised. The money took over. From that time on, he was struggling desperately for a second million and was using it entirely for the fulfillment of his own ambitions. When he had nothing, he was ready to share it. When he had something, he was ready to keep it. And the little tree died again. And so it goes on all kinds of levels of activity. Now, most people are not involved in large enough projects to make it impossible for them to take care of a small backyard kitchen garden. They have always the right in themselves to keep certain beautiful thoughts and ideas. I know people who have a small plot of land, maybe 25 feet square, and they raise all kinds of beautiful flowers on that little piece of land. They never expect to win prizes. They are not out competing for glory. They're not selling the flowers for profit. But they love to work with the earth and to make beautiful things happen. And these people have a physical symbol of a successful happiness tree. They are doing the things that fulfill their own love of beauty, their own protection of life. They become aware more and more of the magnificent problems of growth in nature. They see the wonders of things the average person overlooks, and they develop greater faith in the divine plan simply because of the berry bushes in their own garden. It's all in an attitude. Either this attitude helps the little tree to grow, or it gives it an early frostbite. So wherever you are working with yourself in any way and anxious to gain a little insight, I think it's necessary to realize that religion is not here to make people miserable. Philosophy is not to make people so heavy nobody else likes them. Wisdom is not something that makes you obnoxious to other people. It's what you do with these things that determine whether you are building a healthy garden or whether you have planted something that will never amount to anything when it does develop. So the person who wants a better religion must find a religion which has with it happiness. And this is a problem we are particularly confronted with now. At the present time, we have several first-grade wars, largely over what is it best to believe. What faith do you want to follow? Are you going to do what I believe, or is it going to be my painful duty to eliminate you because you do not? These kind of things do not always come out in major conflicts, but I've noticed a great many people who have what they call deep religious convictions, who simply are not having any happiness out of it. Being right should be the greatest source of happiness in the world. And being right should give us the insight to know how to handle the problems of those around us who do not agree with us. There is no reason why any belief should break in and interrupt the normal flow of human relationships. We have a perfect right to our belief, and they have a right to theirs. Usually there's no problem arise until somebody tries to sell something to somebody else. When I can't be happy with my faith until you accept it, there's a heavy frost in the garden. people are not going to buy this. They're not going to change. Therefore, you cannot be happy, because happiness depended on these other persons doing what you required of them. Off goes happiness, and I know cases where the happiness died for three generations over circumstances like this. The individual is not happy even when he believes he has the right religion, because then he begins to worry about the people who have another religion. At the same time, they're worrying about him, but he doesn't know that and doesn't care. So goes happiness goes to nothing. The same is true in a great many other areas of activity. The person who has artistic skills, it isn't necessary that every musician has to gain top billing for something. Music is a satisfaction of the soul, primarily. A person who is creditable at it, it has made a very definite contribution to life. Now, a creditable musician is probably one who would not last 5 minutes on a professional stage, but he is making himself happy by being able to do something. And his relatives and friends, if they have happy trees of their own, are glad to let him sit under the shade of them. The point of the matter is that the person has to be happy by doing something, by expressing something, not by arguing, combating, and refuting. And in other fields, it's the same thing. Stylization, the way people dress, the way people think, these things are always important to others. The eccentric person makes a career of being eccentric, or perhaps even a religion of it. But he does not really have any happiness tree, because his religion is not based upon his love of God and the service of his fellow man, but with content with his own peculiarities. As he does as he pleases, this is freedom. But the money-free people are in absolute slavery to what they please. So this isn't the answer to happiness. Eccentricity is not an answer. Belligerence is not. Revolution, rebellion, anarchy are not. Even though the principles may be declared to be right, there is no great virtue in nature in doing right the wrong way. And each person has to live with what it does to the inner part of his own life. So we have to begin gradually to follow the Zen idea. So we suddenly come to the realization that taking care of this little tree is not exactly easy. But it is very gratifying, and it fulfills almost immediately great needs in human nature. It gives each person the ability to live with others in a gentle, kindly relationship. So if you want to get into the idea of this Zen Mentagarten, this garden of the mind, you just look over what you're doing. What kind of books do you read? What kind of people do you have for friends? What kind of educational aspirations do you have? What are your hobbies? What are your pleasures and privileges? How are your attitudes towards your children, your friends? How are your business attitudes to the office in which you work? Are you constantly competing to try to get a higher job away from someone else? All of these things are constantly in the mind, and they are always the cause of sorrow. Now, in the story of the happiness tree, there is the problem of the fruit. Now, most everybody, when they have a nice fruit tree, whether it's apples or pears or peaches, kind of looks forward to having some fresh fruit someday, and maybe putting up a little preserve against the future. So when we get to the point where there are various forms of fruit forming on the happiness tree, we may decide we'd like to eat them. And then we taste them, and we may have an unhappy surprise. Because of the way we have lived and thought, the fruit is sour, bitter, and not pleasant to taste. That is consequence coming back from cause. If you want good, happy, healthy fruit that makes good jam,
We have to put it in there in the form of thoughts, emotions, and actions that have harmonious consequences and will bring happiness to all who are concerned. Now, a lot of people don't worry too much about happiness until they get to the age where they do not have other immediate objectives. While we live in a sphere of ambitions and responsibilities, where our first thoughts must naturally be to families and friends and to the job we have, the future seems a little far away, and we say busy enough so that the problem of happiness doesn't sit directly on us. Perhaps we haven't even gotten time to plant the tree back there yet. Or perhaps we had a good piece of ground and we watered it and put a lawn in, but we intended to put some flowers in someday. And that is the way in our mental and emotional lives things go. But when the time comes and we begin to settle down a little bit and we want a little peace of mind, the Zen monk goes to his bamboo grove, which he has been taking care of for years, and the Taoist monk may go to his happiness tree, which is now in full bloom and very pleasant and covered with delicious fruit, and settle down quietly to enjoy the rewards of a good life. If so, then we find that the happiness tree has its roots in the form of interests that linger on to make us happy, good relations with other people who do not find us impossible, as in some cases, and with all the joys and happiness of grandchildren who love us, and all kinds of good friends and neighbors, and civic activities and contributions to good causes, and taking a day off to serve the public library. All of these things become pleasures. They add up to happiness, because there are things we're doing we've always wanted to do. There are things that have no particular rewards. We're not working for money. We are working because it gives us an inward joy. It helps us to live always in the shade of our own happiness tree, because the things we are doing are the things we want to do. It isn't a problem of profit, it's a problem of fulfillment. So this is what you can do if you get started right. Now, when you get started, you probably will find either religion or philosophy will have an influence in the decisions that you make. These are the factors which more or less lead people to an attempt to improve their lives. So if you get a religion, be sure you get one that basically is happy. Happy in the sense that the persons involved in it believe in the good in God, believe in the joy of a good life, believe that the things that are proper according to the teachings of the Master are also the things that make us happy here and now. And we find that to be friendly with one another, each to share the problems of one another, these things ultimately have a rich, deep happiness. It may not be so funny at the moment, and it may be a nuisance sometimes to be called away to help someone in trouble when we would rather be doing something else. But if we really have the happiness tree in there, we will say the greatest happiness is to serve this person who needs. And we are happy. We control, direct, and censor what makes us happy, and simply refuse to accept false values in happiness. To take attitudes in which the things that make us happy are not doing us any good. The alcoholic says the good drink makes him happy. We know this is not true. We know that all forms of negative attitudes, while they bring a certain self-centered satisfaction, contribute nothing to the integrity and happiness of the person. So at any moment we feel like it, we can even find somewhere, perhaps, a little potted plant that we can have in the house. We don't have to have acreage in order to work this out. What we have to have is intent. One small potted geranium can do it. It has done it for millions of New Yorkers, and I guess it would work here also. But something that is a symbol of life, something that asks us for protection, something that if we neglect it, it fades, and a joy of its own beauty disappears. Something of this nature to become a symbol of thoughtfulness. If the individual is thoughtful enough to take daily care of a pet animal, take daily care of a fish in the bowl, take daily care of a plant in a pot. If this is a service that is recognized as a symptom and symbol of lovingness toward life, it will help. It is part of the process of gradually outgrowing indifferences which arise out of ignorance and self-centeredness. Now, many people can also profitably sit down and look over this ambition matter a little more closely. In most instances, if the individual has reached middle life without the glamorous fulfillments that he has hoped, and he is not obviously going to be a unique person with a destiny beyond imagination, then it is time to represent ourselves as in search of peace, search of realities. After all, peace is one of the great forms of happiness. But an individual who is not properly trained inside can't stand peace. Therefore, he can't attain happiness. He must be constantly irritated or agitated. Otherwise, he's lost because he has nothing inside himself. He cannot go out and sit under the tree which is shading him with its own virtues, which are his own good works. So if we find, as time goes on, that in all probabilities we're not going to be removed from the labors we have until the right time comes, and we're not going to be able to change destiny as far as the fulfillment of outside worldly conditions may be concerned. Therefore, now we must reorganize our sense of happiness to begin to look for the things that are the source of real happiness and find out if we can, if we shut any of them off. To find out whether or not in selfishness or indifference or thoughtlessness we have closed our minds to something that could make us very happy. That we have no time for some little things that would make others happy and make our own lives more simple, more direct, more peaceful. Also, the time begins to come in where we should take account of what has happened to us. Most people who are very fretful have simply overlooked many good things that have helped them, and they don't even realize it. I remember the little story of an elderly lady who considered herself accident-prone. When she was 12 years old, she fell in the barn and broke a wrist. When she was 84 years old, she slipped in the barn again and broke the wrist the second time. As he was being set, she said, "That's my life. Nothing but trouble."